Welcome back to the program. Maybe it's just because we're in a political season and the culture war issues are coming to the surface, but it does seem that there's been a lot of talk lately about the 60s and the changes wrought by them. In fact, though, it was the 70s where the 60s came to happen. Our guest today, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon, uses some of the ideas and events of the 70s as a backdrop for his contemporary new novel, Telegraph Avenue. Michael Chabon is the best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Wonder Boys, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. It is my pleasure to welcome Michael Chabon back to this program to talk about his newest work, Telegraph Avenue. Michael Chabon, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's nice to be here, as
Great.
Always.
Great to have you here. Even though this story takes place in 2004, it does seem in so many ways infused by the events of the 70s and the influence, the hangover from that period of time.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, the two principal male characters in the book, Archie Stallings and Nat Jaffe, both of whom, you know, grew up in the 1970s, play music that was contemporary during that time in the band that they have together. They specialize in selling the music of that period in the used vinyl record store that they own and manage together. One of them, Archie Stallings' father, was a star of blaxploitation movies during the 1970s, but his, of course his star has dimmed considerably since then. And so, you know, certainly in terms of the popular culture that concerns the characters in the book, the two other characters are nurse midwives. Their wives, Gwen and Aviva, are nurse midwives practicing in Berkeley. And, of course, midwifery began to experience a renaissance during that period, during the 1970s, to sort of begin to be restored to its traditional place in the lives of women in that decade. And then the two younger characters, they're two teenage boys in the book, and they're sort of grappling to both filter and remix in their own way the bits and pieces that they have inherited from their parents and from their even their grandparents' generation through a lens of kids growing up in the 2000s.
It's interesting that the 70s often get such a bad rap, but in fact it's had a lot of influence for a lot of years.
Oh yeah, no, I mean it was a decade of excess it's known for its excesses, let's put it that way, both fashion and in terms of fashion and in terms of culture generally, and you know, the sort of, it got tagged with this label, the Me Decade by Tom Wolfe. But I mean, what decade isn't known by its excesses?
Right.
And also, you know, in a way, I think what's often forgotten, what I really admire about the general sort of zeitgeist of the 70s is the degree to which it was conscious of its foolishness, if you will, the degree to which it was conscious of its excesses. I mean, the essay, the Me Decade, was written during the 70s. You know, it was a product of the time as much as all of the things that it sought to criticize. There was a sense of self-mockery, of irony, of wearing its excesses sort of lightly, if you will, that I miss nowadays when everything takes itself so seriously.
Right.
Or else it's just complete, bitter satire, and there's really sort of no middle ground between those two extremes in the popular culture, and I kind of miss the more gentler sense of self-mockery.
And of course, another way you play with it is in the music that gets played in Brokeland Records, in this record store that they have.
Right. Yes. I mean, the music of the 70s is very much a soundtrack for the book, no doubt about it. But, you know, again, filtered and channeled in much the same way that classic hip-hop of subsequent decades, particularly of the 90s and the 10 years after the 90s, you know, drew very heavily for its samples on the catalog of jazz classics from the Blue Note label in the 70s and from other labels during the 70s, but remixed it and reincorporated it in new ways. So it's not like a, you know, these characters are living their lives in the present day,
right,
very much, and dealing with present day issues, in particular with regard to the midwives who are constantly struggling against the insurance companies and the medical establishment generally in a very up to the moment way, and with the guys in their store who are facing the imminent threat to their business, both from big box retailers and from the rise of digital and streaming music and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's not a period piece by any means.
No, it's, if anything, it's sort of the end of an era in a very contemporary way.
Right.
Talk a little bit about Brokeland Records, this record store, which is a kind of gathering place, a kind of bar almost, very Cheers-like in that respect.
Yes, it is. It's a non-alcoholic tavern of the soul, as one of the characters thinks of it. You know, it is a, it's one of a number of such places that you actually do find a lot in this area, in Berkeley and Oakland, where I live. Businesses that don't sell food or drink and yet seem to function in some way or another as a kind of tavern, as a gathering place for people with a shared common interest to come and hang out and talk about whatever it is that forms the basis of that common interest, whether it's used vinyl records or books or knitting or books about African-American history seen through an African-American perspective, or tube amplifiers, or whatever it might be. There are places you can find, you know, sort of to use your reference, you know, where everybody knows your name, you know, places where you can just come and hang out, regardless of who you are, what your background might be, and things like that.
And did I read somewhere that this idea, that the general premise of the story that became Telegraph Avenue, started off as an idea for a TV series?
Yeah, initially that's how I conceived it, as a dramatic series for the TNT network in the late 90s, early 2000s, and you know, I just really loved the world that I had created for that show, that I had proposed creating for that show, but I put it aside and moved on, and I worked on a lot of other projects after that, but I never forgot it, and I kept thinking about it. I think largely because I kept living in this area, and so every time I walked out my door, I was, in a sense, in the world of the show, and I kept collecting encounters and anecdotes and bits of information and filing them away sort of wistfully, thinking, oh, if only I had done that show, you know, I would be able to use this. And at some point, I just thought, well, you know, I could still use it. Just because TNT didn't want to make an hour-long dramatic series out of it doesn't mean it was. It has to be a dead idea, and it wasn't dead to me at all, and I kept thinking about the characters, and finally I just thought, well, let me just give it a try, see if I can do it as a novel. How hard could that be? 5 years later, you know, I knew how hard it could be.
Talk about the midwifery and how that became something that you incorporated into this.
Well, my wife and I have four children, and for our second child's birth, we moved to Berkeley when my wife was pregnant with our second, and decided to use a midwife and for that birth. And so that was my first exposure to midwives and midwifery, and that's when I really, you know, got that clear sense of just how fascinating and how difficult and how important the work that midwives do really is, and just, you know, I immediately had the thought, like, this is so fascinating. I would love to be able to write about this, because it just immediately gives this heft to whatever you're writing about,
mm-hmm.
describing birth and with all of the attendant drama. Even a birth that goes perfectly smoothly is inherently a dramatic thing, and so it just seemed like a natural to try to write about it, and that was right around the period that I was conceiving this series, so it just flowed into it very naturally.
And not unlike the record store, which is threatened by this mega development coming in, as you said before, the midwifery is also threatened by big doctors and big insurance companies.
Right, yes. So, you know, all my characters are sort of in this book are struggling to stay afloat in the oncoming tide of late capitalism in one way or another, as it's manifesting itself in the area on the borderline between Berkeley and Oakland, California.
Talk a little bit about the racial aspect of it, because you have two teams here, both guys that run the record store and their wives that are in practice together, that are black and white.
That was there from the very first glimmer of the idea for this, what became this book. you know, I went into a record store that's unfortunately no longer in business on Claremont Avenue in Oakland, and it was called Berrigan's. And the day that I walked in there, there was a black guy and a white guy working the counter, and the customers who were in there hanging out and shooting the breeze were a mixture of black people and white people. And, you know, that was the idea from the beginning, was just to, you know, looking at this place, that this sort of enchanted space that had been created solely through the shared love of vinyl and of jazz music, that, you know, led to this somewhat enchanted-seeming precinct where it didn't matter if you were black or white. You could just hang out together and talk about stuff you loved.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, it's not race that interests me. It's commonality. It's the human ability to be able to create a space, even a little tiny space like an old record store, in which the differences between us matter less than similarities.
Right. And that's another one of those things, and you alluded to this before, that has gotten far more difficult to deal with today in a more polarized environment.
You know, I think there are forces at work in whose interest it is to make us think that. I don't really believe that's true. You know, I think that things are certainly no more polarized now than they have been before. Things have always been polarized. I think the idea that things are more polarized is just helps sell
right.
The denture whitener or something like that. I mean, I think I don't have any illusions that things used to be better than they are now. Things used to be worse than they are now, in almost every respect. So, you know, I think it's just entropy, the forces of entropy act to, destroy and disorganize order. And so when people work hard and they put their efforts and their love into creating a kind of, a space in which people can come together, it's not necessarily racism or anything that makes that world eventually come apart again. It's in the nature of little worlds to come apart, and big worlds too, and everything does fall apart eventually. And, but then people do it again. And,
right.
That's something that's always been true. And for me, the sort of the ultimate ancestral image of Brooklyn Records in my novel is Huck and Jim's Raft. You know, that sort of, to me, is like the original magical space on which a black person and a white person have come together just sheerly through mutual interest and mutual affection and through a common purpose to create a space where it doesn't matter who they are. And, you know, that's something that's been a beckoning image for Americans, for at least 150 years, if not more. And in a way, I mean, that's the idea of America at its best. That's certainly the idea of the place I grew up, which is a town called Columbia, Maryland, a planned community that was built in the Maryland suburbs in the 1960s that was designed to be interracial, you know, racially integrated and economically integrated and all of those things.
And that was the intent of it from the beginning. I mean, it was set up as sort of this community that would be very much diversified from the beginning.
Right, yes. No, Columbia was a utopian project in many ways. It was intended to be racially integrated, economically integrated, religiously ecumenical. It had big swaths of public open space and open classrooms. And you know, it was a... We moved there in 1969, and I lived there for the next 11 years, and those were truly my formative years. And so I grew up in utopia, essentially. I mean, and I experienced both the blessings of that, and it really did completely influence my notions of who I was and what was possible and so on. But also, you know, I suffered the disappointments that go along with it. First, both as Columbia itself lost a lot of its steam over the years, but also leaving Colombia and going out into the quote-unquote real world and discovering, you know, that I had to be living in a bubble, in a sense, in a place like Brooklyn Records or Huck and Jim's Raft, where, you know, as long as you're on the raft, you're okay, but lying on either shore, you know, is nothing but danger and racism and you know, I had to experience that as well.
There's also the difference of something like Columbia. I mean, did you have a sense of it being artificial as opposed to something like Brokeland Records, for example, which evolves more naturally?
I don't know. I mean, I think Brokeland Records is artificial too. And I mean, maybe it was not necessarily the founder's intent to create a place where black people and white people could come together and hang out. But it probably was in their unconscious that would be possible. And I think that, you know, they did nothing to discourage that, let's say, in the way that they lay out their store, that it has this big long counter with stools that people can pull up and sit at. They were very self-conscious and conscious of the fact that before it was Brooklyn Records, it had been a barbershop, kind of traditional African-American barbershop for decades, and before that, when the neighborhood was Italian, it was an Italian barbershop, and both of our store owners are very aware of that history, and so they know that it already has a history of being a kind of a hangout where people can come together. So, you know, I think there was a semi-deliberate utopian impulse underlying the creation of the store, that it was artificial in its way, too. I mean, artificial has a pejorative sound to it, but I mean, another way of saying it is simply deliberate.
Right.
And or making a choice as opposed to just letting stuff happen to you randomly.
Michael Chabon, his new novel is Telegraph Avenue. It's just out from Harper. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.